This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to The Waves for Thursday, July 11th, Hannah and Noreen's last show. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have the lovely June Thomas, senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
Where do you think the convention of the lovely comes from? Do you know what I mean? Like how that trips off your tongue and you're like, the lovely this one? Does that come from cheesy television or game shows or what? Hi, Noreen. Sorry. And Noreen Malone from New York Magazine.
I'm not lovely.
The unlovely heck?
Come on. You're not lovely. And the lovely Noreen Malone.
I think it might come from beauty pageants.
Lovely.
Oh, wow.
Doesn't it sound like a beauty pageant intro?
Oh, fuck. Really?
But here's the thing. Like, who's watched a beauty pageant, even ironically, in many years? So, like, how could that have gotten inside our language so efficiently?
But it feels very 1940s and the lovely Noreen Malone.
Yeah, so like TV intro, TV MC kind of thing.
Yeah, just inherited.
Okay. Well, I take it back then. Before we get started, as some of you might know, this is the last show for me and Noreen, although The Waves will continue to go strong with its new cast and also with June. I want to thank our listeners for the most beautiful emails and notes you wrote. Some of them actually made me cry. Chang, I'm talking to you, who talked about, well, this one's kind of like it's about me, so I'm just going to say it, but it was so sweet. It was like, you're the older sister I never had note, which I thought was so dear. And then there's Lauren H., who's quietly weeping under my sunglasses. Anyway, don't you guys feel that way? I just felt genuinely touched by the kind of intimate, personal nature of some of the notes that we got when we announced that we were leaving.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like sort of verklempt over them.
Yeah,
it's nice because often people write in to tell us when we're doing something wrong.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And now this was like people who've sort of been silent and telling us now that like, oh, thank you, that was really lovely to get.
Yeah, and also just to kind of get like affirmation of things like, you know, when we do our recommendations, is it just a thing that we do at the end of the show? But a lot of people wrote and said, I you know, you've given me such great book recommendations. I know also just from Twitter that people like our TV recommendations. Like, it felt like it was just saying that what we do isn't just a routine that we go through, but that people actually find it useful, which was really gratifying and nice to know.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so our topics for today, the problem with HR in the Me Too era, HR being Hannah Rosen in the Me Too era. I never thought of that. I just wrote it out, and I was like, wait a minute, what do you mean the problem with HR? I have no problems. Second, we are going to talk about the miserable Jeffrey Epstein case and what it's really about. And finally, Fleischman is in Trouble, the new novel by Taffy Brodesher Ackner, an astute commentary on marriage and the novels that we write about it. And then in our Slate Plus segment, June/Beyonce. Do you want to say what we're talking about?
I don't know what that's about, but in our Slate Plus segment, we will be asking, is The Lion King sexist? And I'm going to say no more about it because if you are a member of Slate Plus, which would allow you to support Slate's journalism and also get your podcasts ad-free and often with special segments like The Waves, Is It Sexist? Here's a preview of that discussion. You can join Slate Plus by going to slate.com/thewavesplus.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of blew my mind because I thought of The Lion King as like the non-problematic Disney movie of my childhood, right? Like I grew up watching Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, which in retrospect, you know, maybe not such great visions of womanhood. But like The Lion King was just like a tale of a kid and the Serengeti and the the warthogs and whatever. I didn't have it filed in my head as problematic. It was sort of the beginning of the era of like good Disney. But no.
All right, let's jump into our first topic, the HR department. Why is it funny just when you say HR? It's funny. I think it's just because of shows like The Office that it's just so easy to make fun of HR departments. I mean, we'll get there, but it's just there is something inherently funny, though it's kind of not funny because of Me Too. But we'll
it's
get
also
there.
Sexist
anyway,
because HR departments are usually women, so there's a lot of sexism in our attitude to HR.
All right, I'm not even why do I need the introduction? I'm going to skip it. It's mentioned in Me Too stories. That's good enough. Women who complain about sexual harassment, it's like they pass through the HR department on their way to nowhere is basically what generally happens. So we're going to talk about HR, its insidious role that it's played in perpetuating the problem, or maybe not, or maybe not. Maybe there's something we're missing about the HR department. This, by the way, got launched by Caitlin Flanagan, who did a very delightful story in a recent Atlantic about HR departments and the role they played. So why don't we start with some examples, like HR mentions in the stories that we all know, like Susan Fowler, who complained about Uber, and she talked about going to the HR department and the role that the HR department serves. Can you guys think of an example, or just to pin in people's minds, like how has the HR department become a player in the last couple of years?
Well, I thought Caitlin Flanagan's opening to her piece was really interesting, that she went off to an HR convention, effectively, a convention for HR professionals or a gathering. And she was kind of expecting a lot of kind of breastbeating and like saying sorry for Me Too. She saw everything that's happened with, you know, from Weinstein on down as an example of the failure of HR. And she thought there would be a lot of kind of, you know, interrogation of their role and all of that. And she found that that wasn't the case, that that was not the attitude of the HR professionals who were at that convention or who talked to her. And actually,
can you just say what it was called? Because the name was so like delightful and made up, but it was true.
So the convention that Caitlin Flanagan visited was called Work Human. And I think that is, you know, which makes some people laugh. And I think that does point to one of the problems that people have with HR, that like there's a lot of euphemisms, that there are a lot of sort of very careful and very like the kinds of things that in the very early days of women's lib, people used to kind of joke about things like person holes or, you know, just like, instead of manholes, I should say, you know, like just weird, you know, like where you're just avoiding words for the sake of it. And I think people often associate that with HR. In fact, even the very concept of human resources. And one of the very strong parts of Caitlin Flanagan's piece was kind of pointing out that, you know, it's odd to think of humans as indeed a resource, but along with sort of facilities and capital and equipment, they are kind of the pillars of productivity. And it's you know, hard to kind of conceive us of ourselves, we workers, as just another component in a product, but that is actually the case. And I think too that just this general sense of HR as being those people who make it so that we have to do those silly trainings and waste our time, you know, answering obvious questions. I personally do not take this view. I think HR, when done well, can be hugely just beneficial to a company and can really change a company. But in Caitlin Flanagan's piece, she was essentially pointing out that HR is there for the company to protect the company.
June, that's what you just said, though. It's hugely beneficial for the company. You didn't say for the worker.
No.
Right?
Yeah,
so,
but I think that's absolutely true.
And I think that's what this maybe put into sharp relief, the piece and also just the Me Too movement, is that like the whole vibe of HR is come talk to us, come tell us your problems, we'll help you solve them, we'll help you like make your way through this really confusing stuff about your 401k, but we are here for you. But actually they are there for the company, and nowhere is this maybe clearer than in cases of sexual harassment, where the major role of HR is to ensure that the company is not liable for whatever may have gone down, right? Like that part of the role of those trainings that all these companies do, I think my company did it, I don't really remember, but it's to protect yourself legally, right? Like mm-hmm. There's no evidence that shows like telling people that grabbing your coworker's breast is harassment will, you know, reduce reduce sexual harassment in the workplace, but it does sort of dot the I, cross the T, so that if there is a complaint, you can say, oh, like, we had a training, we told people how to report it, and she didn't really report it the right way.
Well, I definitely think that it would be just ridiculously naive to think that, like, HR is just there for you and just have this kind of this soft focus view of, you know, this warm, friendly place that's there to help you. At the same time, I do think it's ridiculous to think that, although, yes, they are put in place essentially to protect the company, they do good things. Like, if you have a good sexual harassment training, if you as a company have a mission statement about, for example, inclusion or, you know, non-harassment, then if you keep repeating that statement and if you are serious about the training and if everybody in the company is bought into it, I think you really can remove that behavior. And
no way. You're going to change human nature with a couple trainings?
Yes. Or, I think we've seen that in recent times. I think that it used to be okay, especially for men, let's just say it, for men to say and do certain things. And I think everybody knows it's no longer okay.
And people are still doing it.
Yeah, because humans are still human. And, right. And humans are, there are some who are, I mean, and that is the difficulty, that humans can be cruel, humans can be manipulative, humans can be nasty and exploitative. They can also be kind and nice. But so you do have to, you know, have these policies in place. But I think for those people who aren't evil, kind of saying this is not okay really can kind of get rid of that.
No way. There's evidence that shows that so sure, if in a perfect world, a seamless world where there are no sort of judgments and everything just goes as it should, that sexual harassment happens even though this training, you know, has occurred and someone reports it and the harasser is dealt with and the woman goes on her way and proceeds up the ladder. That's not the way it works in the real world. Even if you do sort of follow the letter of the law and self-report your sexual harassment to the HR department, it turns out to totally affect your career. Like, there's actual data backing this up and it, by the way, affects your career a lot more if you report it yourself rather than if a bystander reports it.
But then again, like, part of HR training should be about being a good bystander, which I was as a slut.
This is...
See, here's the thing.
You're such a company woman,
I know,
Jen.
I realize that, and I hear myself. And I just think, though, that there's a reflection here of, like, Caitlin Flanagan being the kind of writer she is. Of course, she's going to, like, go for certain sort of odd or funny. She's going to, like, really lean into the silly name of the convention. She's going to lean into those trainings, which are annoying. But I think that is also a reflection of how writers tend to be individual contributors. And as you become a manager and as you kind of have maybe more influence in a company, you do see more about why things are important. And yes, they are about protecting the company, but not exclusively.
I'm not arguing with the point of HR more generally. I think that we've seen in recent years that these small companies in particular where HR is deprioritized, there's often way more rampant sexual harassment. The most recent example being this company, this women's media website, babe.net, where there was no HR department and a lot of blurring of lines. But, like, here is what crystallizes it for me on the sexual harassment issue in particular. The thing that launched the Me Too movement was not Susan Fowler and Uber. The thing that launched the Me Too movement was Harvey Weinstein. Most of the cases of the women who are accusing him were not women who worked for him in a traditional HR sense. Yep. Like, in some ways, this movement happened despite HR and in defiance of HR and, like, as a reaction to HR's sort of flaccidness in the face of all of this.
Yeah, and I really don't know what we're going to do in the, you know, as we move more toward a gig economy. I mean, there isn't HR or any equivalent for freelancers, and, you know, that there is a lot of potential for exploitation in that scenario. Hannah, I know you've been conspicuously silent.
She's rating our performance on a scale of 1 to 10 and tying it to our salary with a 2% bonus if we perform.
Absolutely. We'll have an offsite to discuss.
Great.
Yeah, I think this is a timeline question. I mean, what this moment did for me of shining the light on HR is realizing that you should stop thinking of it as a joke, as it often is in office sitcoms, and really just kind of focus on the absolutely insidious, dangerous role that it played, and that HR people work for the company, and you have to be absolutely clear about that. They do exactly what the company says, and they're there to legally protect the company, and that's not funny. And the fact that it's mostly women working in HR is just like an extra ironic twist, you know, where you put women who effectively have no power in the organization, and that's why they end up in this situation. So it's not that funny. And so now we actually like focus on that and know that, because in all of these cases, HR departments, you know, or not in all of these cases, but, you know, and maybe it just means being realistic. We expected too much of them in the first place. They're not a union. You know, the union protects workers. HR departments protects the company. Just remember that, everybody. Remember that, you know. I guess, but actually then this whole conversation is a little bit irrelevant because of what you said, June, the gig economy. And June, I think, you know, you're like, it's, oh my God, it's, what's the right non-patronizing word when the word in my head is cute? I'm like, it's not, that's just so patronizing, but it's like, no, like it's the culture that made, it's not the HR, there was no like revolution of HR departments which made it unacceptable for people to do certain things in the workplace. It was the shaming. It was like the cultural shaming and the kind of huge movement that, you know, in which people like lost their jobs.
Of course. No, absolutely.
You know, people were fired. Like there's no HR department in my workplace or anybody else's workplace that fired any of the, you know, hundreds/thousands of mostly men who were fired. It was the culture that got them fired. You know, you just like, it was the media. It's like you couldn't hide anymore. And so that's scary. And that's why you don't make a pass at someone because, you know, look where you end up.
No, I mean, absolutely. It's not like HR is this force that's separate from the rest of the world. I just think that it's too easy to make fun of, you know, the slogans and the trainings and the, and I think there is a lot of sexism because although it's not 100% female career, it's I think 75%. Most HR professionals are women. And I also think that it's one of those things where like when I worked at a big company, when I worked at Microsoft, I think there was absolutely zero doubt that in a big company like that, and in a very rich company like that, the HR is just absolutely a compliance arm of the company, and it's just making sure that that all the legal it's definitely a dotting and crossing kind of situation.
But isn't it also like the real thing is who sets the tone? Like if Bill Gates, like if the people at the top are kind of reasonable humans. I mean, we're getting into our next topic, Jeffrey Epstein, which this is exactly what we're going to discuss. Yeah. But like how people behave, what behavior is winked at, what's allowed, what people are choosing not to notice. Like that's what matters.
Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I think, you know, HR, there is nothing worse, I think, than a ineffective or unsupported or just unmotivated HR department. That's why if you have a really good HR department, it really does make a difference. It won't solve all of the problems in the world, but if you but you absolutely have to have a mission for the company. They don't have any secret formulas. They don't have anything except these training. But you know what? If you keep repeating, you cannot do this, you cannot repeat, you cannot do this. Yeah, sure, that does, you know, it prevents you from being legally liable. But it also just repeats to people, you cannot do that, you cannot do that. And it's not just HR doing it, but I just think that it's actually very useful.
But the HR scenarios are so comical. They're like cliche cartoons, and then you're also presuming that people stay awake through HR presentations and here's the thing. Just like click through the
Wait,
video.
wait, but they've gotten better. They've gotten better. Like we've now had the next round of sort of sexual harassment training and kind of unconscious bias training. And I think I would say they've like in the decade since the last time I worked at a big company and took them in which it was like, you know, big meaty man puts his hand on your bosom, you know, it's like that, you know, now they are actually reflect what goes down, what possibly goes down in a workplace much better than they used to.
I agree. The trainings have gotten much better. But I also think that we are in a particular field where we all, I think actually probably quite rightly, think that we already know this and it's wasting our time and we don't need this. At the same time, everybody who's, you know, who thinks they're clever and thinks they already know this, in those workplaces, things happen. So, like, clearly people do kind of need it.
I just don't buy that reporting necessarily works. Although, one thing that sort of heartened me, although it speaks more towards the culture changing than towards the efficacy of HR, is that since the Me Too movement, the same study that showed that women who self-reported harassment didn't, you know, were reviewed poorly, or that difference has almost entirely disappeared, that women who self-report harassment are no longer thought of as sort of unpromotable by people in this, in taking, doing this study.
Yes.
Which was kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally love that. I feel like we got to stop talking about the HR job. Okay. It's amazing how deep in we got. You know what I really want to say is, like, if any of you have experiences with the HR department, please share them with the waves@slate.com. You know, we'll look at them and the next show may decide to take them on. But who does not love a good HR story? They're just delicious. And we can also say that since we've all recommended This Could Hurt by Jillian Medoff, we'll recommend it again at the end of the segment. It's a great novel about an HR department.
I was just going to bring it up. And it's about the soul of an HR department and how it actually has heart, which is nice.
Yeah, it's fabulous. It will change. It's on Team June about the HR department for sure. All right. Our next topic, the despicable Jeffrey Epstein. Jesus Christ, is it hard to read these stories? It's like a Stanley Kubrick hell. Like, it's just, is this actually really how the world works? I mean, it's just horrifying. Anyway, jet setting. Maybe he's a billionaire. Maybe he isn't. Maybe he's just a multimillionaire. Jeffrey Epstein just was recently charged with child sex trafficking in cases involving up to possibly 80 teenage girls. His method was allegedly to lure these girls who were somewhat vulnerable to his houses for massages, possibly sex, asking them to recruit their friends. And the thing about Epstein is that he is friends with lots of rich and important people. We will name some of them going on, but it really does add to a picture of conspiracy that I feel is like back to Weinstein. I mean, the reason that this is getting so much attention is because it, like, this, of all the stories, leads you back to the mindset you had when you first read about Harvey Weinstein, which is just, oh my God, is there like a network of secrecy and protection that is totally invisible to us and just shocking, like so shocking. It doesn't even, you know, in our world-weary ways, it just barely seems true. So let's get into the details of what he is alleged to have done. Now, he's already been convicted and had a plea deal once. So let's just start at the beginning and kind of lay out the facts of what he was already accused of and what he is now accused of.
So Epstein has several different homes, one of which is in the greater Miami area. I believe it's actually in Palm Beach. And in 2008, a girl came forward to the Miami police saying that she had been recruited and lured to his mansion to do, as with many of these girls, a nude massage that led to forced sexual acts. And when the police investigated, they found that there was essentially a network of underage girls who had been lured there and exploited. The crime seemed like it could be federally prosecuted. The local police went to the FBI. The FBI investigated. And the problem was that the U.S. attorney in the Miami area at that time was now a member of Trump's cabinet, Acosta, who is now the labor secretary of the United States, cut a pretty insane plea bargain with Epstein. He now says that it was to make sure that Epstein, with all of his money and power, actually went to jail. But what actually ended up happening is, instead of being charged with sex trafficking, which was the original charge, the charges were lessened such that Epstein was, although technically sentenced to jail, was allowed to go to work 6 days a week. And so he just really spent one day a week in prison, which is really extraordinary.
Can we just pause on that? Because it's like he's there 6 days a week. So he's not just merely allowed to do his work. He's allowed to be a workaholic. Like, he's allowed to work, you know, Monday through Saturday, you know, just because his work is so important. He needs like an extra day to get it done.
Right. which is really just extraordinary, especially because no one exactly knows what he does.
Right.
That's the other thing that's emerged from this. I'd always heard of him referred to as a money manager or a hedge funder, but it seems like he maybe only has one client. It's unclear what he actually does for him. That's also like we're getting into conspiracy theory land, mm-hmm. but like, you know, is the procurement of girls in some way part of his business? Like what, like why were there so many? So anyway, so he, you know, and he's added to the sex offender registry. So flash forward to the fall of 2018, a woman who was actually a freelancer with the Miami Herald investigates what actually happened with Epstein and talks to a number of women. And this sort of reopens it. Acosta, being labor secretary, sort of put it back in the news. And then the Southern District of New York, where Epstein also has a home, arrested Epstein last weekend in New York. They raided his house. They found a bunch of CDs with pictures of young girls nude, which might lead to other charges. But for right now, what he's being charged with is sex trafficking, because he did the same thing in New York as he did in, or he allegedly did the same thing in New York as he did in Miami. So I think that kind of brings us up to date. Although then we get into the whole mess of, you know, why was this just sort of an open secret for so long, right? Like it was sort of like almost a punchline. I almost think even back in like high school, I knew Bill Clinton had been on Ron Burkle's jet with Jeffrey Epstein, and it was like gross, but like it had never been like reported like Jeffrey Epstein is, you know, a molester of teenage girls, right? Mm-hmm. Like had it ever been fully reported? I don't think so. It was just sort of this like, these sleazy men like young girls, ha ha ha, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the photos, there are photos of, you know, Trump and Melania and Epstein and whoever his girl is at the moment. And if you think, you know, the people who are mentioned, I'm sure there were a lot of people on his private jet, like this prince, that duke, you know, so many famous people, but it's like also Michael Jackson and also Bill Clinton. So just insinuations that there's just a kind of silent understanding between men with certain proclivities to protect each other or to understand each other in some way, or at the very least not to rat each other out. So that's horrifying because, as you said, Noreen, people knew. It's like Harvey Weinstein. Like mm-hmm. people knew, you know, or he was at parties with lots of different people and his dates were often, you know, 16. And so maybe people didn't know precisely exactly that he was recruiting vulnerable teenagers and having sex with them. But people knew something, you know. So why? What's the system that protects men like him? How should we think about that system? And why was it never let out?
I mean, I think we don't, it's still too early in this particular round of the story to have the answers to that. But it sure seems like being a rich guy, however you got your money, you know, this is going to be a shocking newsflash to a lot of people. But being a rich guy can get you out of a lot of trouble. A rich guy with connections, a rich guy who seems to know a lot of important people, a rich guy who acts like he's super smart, who, you know, is considered a, you know, a great thinker, even though, you know, everybody who's spoken to him says, don't know where that impression came from. Of course they don't, you know, of course the rules that apply to other people don't apply to them. I mean, look at our president.
I think it's actually like a little more universal than that. I think people think it's just not that bad, right? Like someone might have been at a party and been like, oh, he's got a young girl with him. And I think there's something where we think like, it's okay. She's like, she might be 16, but like 16 is not 12, you know? Mm-hmm. And 16
yeah,
isn't
so
12.
Yeah, so he made that defense.
Right.
He made that defense. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's the super uncomfortable part of this case mm-hmm. is like he's legally a child molester, but the defense he makes morally of himself, which has come out not a lot, but, you know, in dribs, is like he in his head makes a big distinction between young girls and young girls, you know, between 13 and 15.
It's like if you look at human history, like a Jeffrey Epstein, you know, was not unusual, but we're not living in the Middle Ages anymore. And we know a lot more about sexual trauma. We know a lot more just about the way that this plays out for people psychologically. There's a reason that our laws are written the way that they're written, right?
I mean, Priscilla Presley was like 14. I'm just thinking of cases like Jerry Lee Lewis of like famous people who were into 14 and 15 year olds. And it was just like, oh, that's cute. Young love. You
and
know?
People, yeah. And people still can marry very young women in a lot of states of this country. But, you know, so there, it's not like this is entirely in the past. I mean, we've seen this over and over again. You know, in Britain, there have been some very famous cases of appalling, huge scale, effectively child molestation involving famous people, I should say, celebrities. And it was almost always done in the open, you know, that people would even be on tape making lascivious comments as, you know, 50-year-old men about 14-year-old girls. And, you know, surprise, they were involved with 14-year-old girls. It's we did used to be more tolerant of this, and I don't think we should pretend that we weren't. And it was always awful.
And we're still a culture that values youth, right? So it's this like weird, complicated mixed message thing where like youth, like supreme youth, like the minute someone turns 18, like, you know, I 10 years ago, I think there were like countdowns to when than 10 years ago, but when the Olsons were going to turn 18, right? There's like that kind of thing. It's like when you're 17 and like three quarters, you're not eligible, but then you become 18 and all of a sudden you're like the hottest thing in the world until you, you know, at 25 fall off the face of the earth, right? So there are like these mixed messages in the culture that are still ongoing. So someone like Epstein, you know, might be venerated for getting like a young hot chick or whatever in certain circles.
I think one thing that we should just note too is that another part of the awful plea deal that he got in Florida was that the charges were around prostitution related offenses, which meant that the girls that he was abusing were considered prostitutes, which, you know, yes, money exchanged hands, but this was not, you know, they were victims.
And wasn't it hush money, essentially?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, if this was not a case of, you know, sex workers and who are, you know, being in the gig economy, these were young women who were being taken advantage of.
Well, and that's why the charge now is sex trafficking, even though it's not like smuggling them across borders. Right. They were sort of pressured into it, groomed.
I want to go back because I felt just some discomfort around the way we were talking about the young women as if what he's being accused of is just, he's accused of rape. I mean, the young women or girls, their range in ages and when they're coming forward are accusing him of actual rape. There's, you know, you couldn't keep up fast enough with the girl/young women coming out of the woodwork. You know, there's a couple every day, like on Fox News and this newspaper, that newspaper are sort of coming out to accuse him. But the word they're using is rape. Mm-hmm. So I just want to point that out. And I also want to point out that the Miami Herald, there's a dogged reporter there who broke this story, is a woman. So as usual with a lot of these stories, it's, you know, it is due to the dogged efforts of female reporters who are tuned in. Same thing happened in Vanity Fair, where it was a female reporter who was charged with doing a profile of him and a male editor who cut this part out of the profile where she had found a mom and her daughter, a mom who had accused him of raping her daughter.
After pressure from Epstein, after direct pressure, after him going to the Vanity Fair offices and sitting down with Graydon Carter and you know, basically saying, convincing him, it seems like, that this was not germane to the story, that this wasn't the main thing.
All right. Well, another monster down, thank God.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, I hope so. And it does seem like, you know, the photographs also bring in a new level of charges. But, you know, he is so rich and he is so well connected. I don't know if he's quite down yet. I don't want to say fatally injured. I obviously don't mean that literally, but like, I hope he's down. But he is so rich and he is so well connected. I wonder, I would have thought he would have been down before, but he was apparently able to continue to do these dreadful things.
Yeah, which again, I think it just means that in certain circles, people think it's not that bad.
Yeah, I also think it's a larger criminal justice problem where income inequality in criminal justice outcomes is insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, we touch on this in little ways, like crack cocaine versus cocaine. Mm-hmm. Like it's come up in discussions here and there, but it's just shocking how the differential outcomes in almost every kinds of case is determined by how much money you have.
Absolutely,
it's weird.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got a chance for outrage in our last topic, in our last show. I'm really glad for that. All right. I am excited to talk about this novel. I read it very quickly. Fleischman is in Trouble. It's a new novel by Taffy Broser Ackner. It tells the story of a dissolving marriage from the perspective of her husband, Toby, until suddenly it doesn't. Now, listeners, here is where I'm going to jump in and assume this is my last damn episode of The Waves Privilege. It is really hard to talk about this novel without spoiling it because it has a pretty complicated structure, which if we can't talk about it, it just is a little stifling. So I'm going to say that if you haven't read the novel, you really should skip this segment. Go and read the novel. It's a very quick read, and then come back and listen to the segment. I'm sorry. If you want to listen to it, that's great, but we are going to spoil critical bits of the novel. Anyway, so to continue with the sentence I was saying, it's from the perspective of the husband, and then it suddenly isn't. And it brings the women into the picture, his agent wife, Rachel, his college friend, Libby. It's a subtle and convincing portrait, but also its real project, which is how and when women count, comes through pretty clearly. So should we start by describing the characters? Noreen, you want to take a shot at Toby? What kind of guy is he? He's a doctor. He's in the range of appealing but selfish. Like, he's like, nobody's an extreme in this novel, which is the thing I find most interesting about it. Like, nobody's exactly an asshole. You know, it's all in a kind of range of believable. So why don't we just start with Toby, since he hogs a good bit of this novel?
Sure. Toby Fleischman is in his early 40s. He is a liver doctor, I believe.
Yes.
Which is a
hepatologist.
Hepatologist. I have a pet theory. That's why I said liver doctor, because I can't say it. But I also have a pet theory that it's like in some way a call out to Portnoy's complaint with the liver.
Yes.
Because she is trying to do some kind of like Roth thing here. Anyway, he works at a fancy hospital. He has a good job where he makes, you know, what would in any place other than the Upper East Side of New York be a ton of money. But he thinks of himself as sort of very middle class, especially compared to his wife. He's, you know, in the throes of a divorce. He is on Tinder in a very big way, and he is feeling sexual confidence for what feels like maybe the first time. He's a short man. Mm-hmm. That becomes a recurring theme. He's a short man who's like concerned about his weight because he had been heavy. So he has all of these. He has this kind of like body consciousness that you more often associate with women, which was kind of an interesting move. He is a devoted father, and he thinks that his ex-wife
maybe
right in maybe. Well, in the first half of the novel, we are given to understand that Toby Fleischman is
and believe.
Right. Is a great father, and his wife only cares about her work. Right.
She cares
about
work
and
social
money.
Climbing.
She's a social climbing, money grubber who doesn't care about her kids.
Her kids are tool. Like, she cares about her kids insofar as they fit into the social environment in a very, very particular way. So, like, they have to get into the right schools. They have to do this. They have to do that. Like, she cares about them to that degree.
Right. And then, that's the Toby perspective. And then, Hannah, one of you want to tell us about how it shifts in the second half?
It's actually later than it's later than half. I mean, one thing I think about in this novel, because I became impatient once I finished the novel, I sort of was annoyed that I had to spend so much time with Toby, you know, that like I understand what it was doing is drawing me into Toby's perspective, making me sink into it in a way that I just didn't even think about, that I was not self-conscious, like I didn't think twice about, but it did that, you know, like extra super duper thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But then it made me think, oh, well, maybe that is another thing that this novel has a Hall of Mirrors quality where it's like you think it's about this and then it's about this, but then it's reflected back at this. And one thing is it makes you think about who gets to take up space. So like this little man, little in stature, actually takes up a huge amount of space. I mean, you live inside his head. you know, if you literally just kind of weighed the novel and took the Toby pages and put them on the scale, like, he takes up a ton of space, mm-hmm. where actually the kind of turmoil and drama is happening with Rachel, his wife. It's just that she is squeezed into a much more narrow space, even though she's the one actually having a breakdown and, to me, going through the much more intense transformation. Mm-hmm. And then there's this sort of final twist, which is his friend Libby, his college friend Libby, who's popped up here and there, but it turns out is actually the author of this book. And so she's a kind of ether over the book. She doesn't exactly take up space. She just kind of... She's the kind of air, like, that she just comes into the cracks of the novel. And so I think, like, literally, architecturally, the novel is kind of making a point with, mm-hmm. with space, you know?
And the sort of talismanic key to the whole thing is Libby, before she stopped working to stay at home with her kids in New Jersey, which she sort of hates, wrote for men's magazines, and she talks about how people will only pay attention to a story if it's about men, which, like, when you say it like that, it sounds a little bit on the nose, but that's sort of, and Taffy Professor Agner used to write for GQ. She writes magazine profiles. She sometimes writes about men. She sometimes writes about women. But that is clearly the idea that she's prosecuting in this book, right? Mm-hmm. She didn't want her book to be dismissed as chick lit, but she also wanted to do a more interesting thing than, like, Jennifer Weiner, who goes and complains about how everyone writes about her chick lit as chick lit, right? And this is not chick lit. I'm not right. saying that's chick lit. I'm just saying that, like, it's a sort of sophisticated trick and statement about the way we read novels, mm-hmm. and talk about
novels. Because, in fact, Libby has written a book that's largely about a man. I mean, that is functionally what this book is. It's, like, largely
you mean Taffy? Taffy has. Man. Or Libby. Are we complaining
Taffy
Libby?
Slash Libby. Taffy slash Libby. Like, if Libby is a Taffy character who has spent her career writing about a man, in fact, she's the author of this novel we have just read. Within the novel, she wrote the story of Toby. And so she did, in fact, spend a lot of time writing a novel about a man. What did you think about there are points when the novel jumps out. Like, this has been quoted in a lot of the reviews, this line, whatever kind of woman you are, even when you're a lot of kinds of women, you're still always just a woman, which is to say you're a little bit less than a man. Did you need those things?
No.
Do you know what I mean? There are parts when it just, like, jumped out in that way.
Yeah, there were a few sort of, I don't know, aperçu, you know, a few things that if you were reading it on a Kindle would probably be underlined because many people had highlighted them as they were reading. But they didn't take me out of the book. They weren't necessary, but I didn't find them, you know, they didn't spoil the book for me. And I think if you're a writer, probably that's one of the sort of magazine writer things, that, like, a magazine writer, if you can plant two or three of those good lines in a piece, like, that's a definite plus for a magazine piece. And I think you don't need them in novels. You can be less showy in this kind of novel anyway. And I think, but it didn't bother me.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff felt on the nose. Where I was interested in the sort of thinking about gender that she was doing was what money means in a marriage, mm-hmm. what, like, who makes the money, how that dictates who has the power. And even if you have the power in a marriage, that doesn't necessarily mean good things for your marriage, right? So during the Toby section, you know, he goes to a divorce lawyer who tells him that functionally, because he makes something like $300,000
he makes like $250,000,
but his wife is a very successful talent agent, makes, you know, untold amounts where she can buy a Hamptons house just sort of on a whim, it seems. Anyway, the divorce attorney tells him that functionally he's the woman, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he has this nice cute job as a doctor, but he is the, like, distaff spouse. Mm-hmm. I found it sort of bleak on the subject of what it does when a woman makes more money than a man in a marriage.
Well, there are a lot of things where it's bleak. It's funny, there was an interview in The Guardian that was, yeah, fine, but not hugely remarkable, but it had this phrase, like, that I think the question was something like, this book is very bleak about ambition. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a very accurate representation. Like, it's bleak about ambition. It's bleak about money. It's bleak about sort of understanding each other. Like, there's both Rachel and Toby feel that the other is very angry. They feel that the other one is angry and they don't understand the source of the anger. And I guess the whole point of the book in many ways is just that they don't understand each other. There's a lack of comprehension. They believe Toby especially, he sure he understands Rachel, and he's just totally wrong about her. He doesn't get her at all.
And the same thing with the Libby marriage, right? Where she has stopped working. Her husband's a lawyer and he works. She stays home with the kids. And she has sort of like a...
like a rumspringer,
right? That was exactly the word I was searching for. Yeah, where she starts like going into the city all of the time and hanging out with her friends and smoking cigarettes and going to late night movies because she feels so trapped and her husband is confused by it and she hasn't talked to him about it. He's the least complicated character mm-hmm. in this whole thing. He's like a paper doll of a nice mm-hmm. guy, right? And she...
tall.
Right, and she doesn't seem to have any like... he doesn't have a personality and she's just like, this is a good man who loves me. I should be happy. And yet I'm not. So that was sort of depressing too.
Can we just dig into the bleak for a moment? Mm. Because this is the thing that I am thinking about, is the book's bleakness and kind of how to digest it. I mean, when I read about Rachel, who's essentially having a nervous breakdown, mm-hmm. I also was put into mind of a recent op-ed by Lara Bazelon, sister of Emily Bazelon, about being a single mother and loving her work. Mm-hmm. And it was a recent New York Times op-ed, and it was just like, it was essentially about the price that women pay for hunger mm-hmm. of certain kinds, mm-hmm. like hunger, ambition. It's not clear, there is no, well, I'll talk about her gynecologist in a minute, but yes. If we can just leave him off the table, it is not clear who is the devil in Rachel's life. Like, it's not like you get to the end of the book and you're like, oh, her husband's the devil. It's not exactly like that. It's not clear what's driving her. It's not clear why she's driven. I mean, there's like a personal backstory. There's clearly a sort of dissatisfaction that she is left with. She's, you know, and was an orphan raised by a cold grandmother. So there's explanations of who Rachel is and why she is why she is. But essentially what you're left with is like, here's the person who has a tremendous hunger for herself, for her children, and that hunger is unacceptable. Like, there's no space for that hunger. I mean, this is the way I understood it, which is that, like, in these Philip Roth novels and in the entirety of Philip Roth's writing career, you know, and John Cheever and sort of the men of that generation, it is taken for granted that men can have a tremendous dissatisfaction and hunger for no reason at all. Because life is boring in the suburbs, because whatever. It's just like a thing that visits you sometimes, and you may have a wonderful wife and everything may be okay, but suddenly is visited upon you some just like fierce dissatisfaction. And that is just a trope. That's like a novelistic trope. We all accept it, you know? So we're sort of like lulled into Toby's point of view. But when Rachel has it, it's just wrong. You know, and we just don't know what to do with it or like where to put it. And so the only place she can end up is like, you know, functionally homeless, like abandoned by her lover, getting no satisfaction out of that relationship and, you know, sitting in a street park looking like a homeless person. And that's what I found bleak is like I that felt very 19th century to me. And I'm not sure if I want to resist that or like mm-hmm. be like, yeah, that's how it is. I don't know. You know,
well, her whole downfall is actually precipitated by her husband, right? Like she doesn't have the breakdown. She doesn't want the divorce. She doesn't even, I believe, initiate the affair until her husband starts asking for the divorce, right? Like, so he gets bored and sort of upset with his wife for wanting. And so that is what sort of, I guess, in that way, it is like her wanting that sort of sets the whole thing into motion. But in a like sort of practical way, he's the one who like sends her off into the wilderness. She was sort of relatively satisfied with her life, you know, and she's like sort of this stupid...
I mean, was she? It was just like, well, she had this hunger that was just like, I want my children to be. And it's, again, it's not clear where it's coming from. You're led to believe that it's this crass social climbing.
Well, it's her,
but
well,
it's clear that it has an edge beyond that.
Well, that's, I mean, her childhood, right?
Right. The whole Toby thing sees it as crass social climbing, but we see that it's actually... it's a part of, there's some social climbing, but mostly it's driven by her cold, deprived, unloved childhood. Yeah,
right, where she was in contact with wealthy people but not one of them, right? Like that was sort of made very clear, I thought. Mm-hmm.
But isn't it at the edge of like, it should be at the edge, like even the way she does her work is like at the edge of passion obsession. Like she's clearly a very good agent, you know, and she's a very good talent scout, and it's like, it's all could be seen as just kind of passion, ambition, you know, want the best, making up for a hole in childhood, but it just falls into a like a dark hole. Like, I mean, Toby doesn't understand it. Right. Nobody understands it. And so she's alone.
I mean, yeah, it is worrisome how close she comes to absolute destitution, and that that might be the outcome, that that is not an outcome that I want. However, it doesn't seem that crazy to me, because I feel like I know where her hunger comes from, not only psychologically, which is revealed more toward, you know, more toward the end of the book, but it also comes from her seeing that she can't play fair. She can't, like, that everything is unfair. So one of the things that happens is that, you know, she works hard and she doesn't get a promotion. You know, we don't know for sure because she was pregnant, but she doesn't get the promotion. She just has to kind of live with it. She has the baby in a way that is, you know, as you mentioned, you alluded to earlier, Hannah, in a very traumatic way. She's effectively, you know, physically damaged by a doctor who's doing it for his convenience and for the convenience of his hospital, so that her water breaks. And that's very, very physically traumatic to her.
And she has no place to complain about that.
Right,
it's like she has to go to a rape group.
Right.
Was she really raped? No. Like, unless you fall under the certain categories, like you were raped, or like you were, like, you have to be in category X, Y, Z, or there's just like no place for your desperation and malaise.
Right.
You know?
And she is just kind of generally suffering from life is unfair. Is that, like, things don't work out as they should do. She goes out. She starts her agency. She's a great agent. She works all the hours. She's mean to her underlings, at least as far as we hear from, you know, from people who we don't necessarily trust, this side of the conversation. But
she's like Zeke. She's like, she's like Ari Emanuel. You know,
well, but
like,
but it's not funny. But yeah, but like, she's clearly a very driven agent, and being an agent is not about being a nice person. However, I also am aware that we only see her kind of drive from other people's perspective. Toby, you know, again, thinks of her as a terrible mother. It's only because he's not recognizing how her, not only her income, but the work that she does that he doesn't even recognize. He just doesn't see it. And he's so puffed up with his self-regard about how he sees himself as this perfect father, which he actually isn't. So I am worried about us falling for, like, other people's versions of her workaholism, when, yes, she works hard and she works long, but I don't know that we should trust how other people see her work and report it.
Okay, I have a theory. So I can't remember where I read this, but I read years ago that it's a very common fear for extremely successful women, particularly New York women. Probably I read this in the New York Times style section, that they will become a bag lady. Like, not just like I'll lose my job, whatever, that they will actually be on the street and be a bag lady. And so I think that's what this is. Mm-hmm. It's like there's no middle ground here. There's not like, you know what, I'll just like scale back to, you know, 30 hours a week or whatever and spend a little more time with the kids. It's like either I'm on top of the world or buying the Hamptons. Like it's this total anxiety that if I can't twirl all the plates at once, then I'm just literally going to be homeless in Central Park, kind of walking around with a bad haircut. There's like there's all or nothing, having it all or having nothing. Mm-hmm. Like everything
but
is
so
stressful.
But that's what's bleak to me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's like Madame Bovary. It's like like depressed with your suburban like, have we made no progress? Like 100 years later, you're just kind of dissatisfied with your boring suburban existence, and so you end up eating arsenic. Like those are your choices, and that's what I wonder about in this book. Although there is this kind of like Rachel knocks on the door and goes home ending, which is like, what? Like, where did that come from?
Yes.
So I didn't know what to make of that. Yeah. Well, can we sneak in Libby for a minute? Like, she also depressed me. I was like, because she, I don't know how I, that kind of trapped also, like, it was the combination of Rachel and Libby which made me feel especially suffocated, because it's like Rachel, this hyper-ambitious mode. Okay, well, that didn't work out so well. That left her with no voice. Like, here's an agent who can speak for other people, mm-hmm. but cannot express, you know, can't find a place to say things about herself or be understood. Mm-hmm. And then here's Libby, who made the opposite choice, which, you know, in terms of how we think of women's choices and children and all that. And like, she makes the opposite choice, and she is also has no place to speak, except then she writes this novel.
I mean,
but she's also got no place to be.
I think there is at least a little bit of hope in her story that she does recognize as the story progresses how these people who she has chosen to be her friends, who she's neglected her, you know, what did you call him, paper doll hero husband, and her kids, not in a, you know, terrible way, but she has neglected them a little bit. She's chosen her dude friends, and she does realize who were from her college days. She does realize over the course of the book that they are not worthy, that Seth is a raging asshole, and that Toby is very, very selfish. He never asks her about herself. He's not interested in anybody but himself. And so I think the fact that she realizes this, and that she does write a book that does reveal, you know, that does eventually reflect an understanding of these people. I think that is the hope. Like, it feels that both Toby, especially in his extremes of eating, and Rachel in her extreme ambition, they both show that, like, that's actually not desirable. And it feels like Libby is more in the middle. She's not an extreme person, but she also comes to understand, and she comes to kind of recognize the benefits of what she has. So to me, it's like she's more of a, I'm happy in the middle, and I'm seeing.
But she doesn't have a job. She's.
But she has a life.
No, she wrote this novel. She does have a job.
Is that?
She's just unresolved. She wrote this novel.
Does it become clear that it's a novel that she's written, or are we talking about Taffy here?
Like that Fleischman is in trouble is, I think we are supposed to think, okay, is the book that writes.
I was like just powering through. Actually, I was so like reading quickly because I was sort of addicted to this book for as bleak as I did find it.
It
was completely like just candy.
Yeah, I read it in 2 days, which is much faster than I typically read books. And I did not feel bad about that. I really enjoyed it.
So will you guys answer my question? Like, is it, like, I don't know how to think about, like, is it just like, this is the depiction of reality for women? There's a small space you can operate in, you know, you sort of step outside that space and you're a bag lady.
So I don't know. I mean, I was on a text chain, long running text chain with several people around my age, all of whom had happened to read the novel. And I said, I found the gender politics sort of depressing. And everyone else was like, yeah, but maybe we're just not in our 40s yet, which was even more depressing. Yeah. So I can't tell if it's just like I'm living in La La Land, or there's something like weirdly conservative about what's happening here.
I mean, I do. And Hannah, I do think that there is one path that's presented as not being awful, and it's Libby. I mean, I do think that there is a vision of Toby and Rachel both in their own way going too far. And Libby presents a version of life that is not so extreme, that is not so demanding of total discipline, total focus on, you know, on your children's development, on your path upward. And I feel like she's the more positive outcome. So Libby, I think, is our happy outcome.
She's a heterosexual mom, like trapped in the suburbs.
But that's what she is.
That's June's dream.
That's what she is. I mean, I don't know that that's...
It's, that's the moral of the waves. Yeah. Is that the only...
I mean, that's what the character
the only
is.
Road she doesn't to happiness.
Seem, she doesn't seem happy to me. She's
in New Jersey.
I think to be the least happy of all of them.
Oh, no. To me, the fact that she at least... she sees the assholeness of Toby, she sees the pain of Rachel. I've been like, is it bleak? Yes, it's still bleak, but to me that is like an alternative to bag lady or you know, self-righteous, self-satisfied guy who isn't what he thinks he is.
Well, you can see that for the novelist it would make a certain amount of sense to say that, you know, she's talked about being a child of divorce and the impact that had on her. You know, she's talked about a lot of these different issues. I mean, you know, I'm not equivocating life novel so simple-mindedly, but you could see that for the novelist, a path would be not so much that she goes back to her husband, she goes back to the suburbs, that she's mild, but that she's a writer. So that you know, the road to redemption is not like the not like the train to Hoboken, but the road to redemption is the ability to kind of step outside and kind of observe what's going on and include the women's reality in the story. So it's not actually just Portnoy's complaint. Like you know, the women get the last word in this novel, and both of them do. You know, one in a kind of novel in the inner structure of the novel, and one in a kind of totalizing way, like I wrote this, and so I think that maybe that's like just a recognition or sort of a consciousness about all this, or sort of like even if the voice that you're giving to the women is a voice of misery, at least it's a kind of it's an inclusion of their very particular reality in this story of a failing marriage or of dissatisfaction in marriage, because as I started, it's been like historically the novel of marriage takes for granted is kind of male suburban dissatisfaction. So now it's like, well, there's a female version of this too, you know? So that's where the redemption comes in, is just in like voicing that, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe. How's that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can live with that.
Any hope there? A little bit of hope? Okay. Good. Well, listeners, we really recommend you read this novel. Fleischman is in Trouble. I know we've made it sound bleak, but it's actually unbelievably delightful to read. Will be very recognizable in its how we live now-ness. And I think quite new and interesting in its structure. And she's such a great writer and observer of human behavior. So definitely high recommend. Well, that... Oh, no, we get to recommend first. Sorry. Okay. June, you want to go first? What's your recommendation?
Yes. So my recommendation this week is going to be something, an entire genre that I am experiencing for the first time. And so maybe it will be weird to recommend the thing that I'm watching, because maybe it's not a very good example of this thing. But I love it so much that I can't believe that. So it is a K-drama, that is to say a Korean drama, and it's called Sky Castle. And it's actually relevant to a lot of the topics we've been talking about today. It's about elite South Korean families preparing their children for life, and specifically for college, and the extreme lengths that they go to so that their children have an opportunity to get into the three exclusive medical schools, the three most, you know, the kind of the Ivy League / Oxbridge of South Korea, and specifically to medical school. And it is like a great soap opera. It's absolutely devastating about ambition and about kind of living through your children and about discipline. And it also has comedy, and it also has a little bit of romance, so very little. It is absolutely not a romance. And it's just fantastic. There's 20 episodes of this season, and I am on, I think, episode 7. And I am just hoovering it up any opportunity I get to sit and watch. I can't resist it. So I highly recommend it. I'm watching it on Rakuten Viki, but I just put it in my Apple TV. I just searched for it and found it. So Sky Castle, my first K-drama, which I think is a really good one.
My daughter was making fun of me. I'm not allowed to mention her on the show, but since it's the last show, I'm going to do it. She's making fun of me. She's like, "You're going to recommend that women talk to each other?" It's like, yeah, I am. No, I'm not going to recommend that. So I tried to do in my head as I was coming over, I was like, yeah, you guys should keep your minds open and talk to your girlfriends about things and don't assume you know anything and keep up the open conversations. And, you know, the thing I love about this show is... working stuff out, like just I this is really, I'm not doing this well with the lack of corniness, but I do will miss that. And I was thinking, oh my god, so the thing I really have to establish in my life is finding people who are as smart and awesome as the two of you to work stuff out with. Impossible, I know, but not like just reinforce or just like read and then I already know, but like figure stuff out with, you know, which has been such a beautiful thing. And I've basically done that with you guys instead of like finding people to do it with in my day-to-day life. So I really recommend it. It's my real recommendation is Years and Years, by the way, that British near future drama. It's so good. This 6-part drama on BBC One, which is about this particular family, the Manchester family, and it follows them sort of from 2019 to 2034. So it's a second Trump era, and it's the aftermath of Brexit, and it's really, really great.
And it's made by Russell T. Davies, who is maybe the greatest TV writer in Britain. And there are lots of good ones, but he's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's amazing and I love it. But somehow, please, you guys can articulate my corny recommendation better than I can. But it is the thing that I genuinely recommend is find some friends who you can like start from A without a lot of fear and sort of figure out what you actually think in the details and nuances about the million things that are happening in addition to listening to the waves, but also do that in your own life, which is what I have to do.
Hannah, I know people who have article clubs, like they instead of doing a book club, they just read an article or two and talk about it. I feel like that can be a version of this for people in their own lives where, you know, if you like choose the right article, you can do it that way. Although I've never been in an article club, so I don't know. I think this is our article club.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we do.
It's true. I've actually had people write me over the years where they're like, oh, we read this article of yours. Will you come to the article club? Or we were trying debating about whether you meant this or that in your article or whatever. So I think that's really good. So you can start by listening to the waves and then having your own article club on alternate weeks when the waves is not on the air. Noreen, what do you got?
Well, I wish I had a summarizing goodbye, but instead I'm going to squeeze in two novels. One I'm going to recommend now because this is my last show and it's not out till the fall, but I won't be doing this show in the fall. And it's by a man, I know. But it's The Topeka School by Ben Lerner. Ben Lerner is one of these novelists who on paper I should hate. He's like, you know, like was this wunderkind guy who writes these, you know, thinly veiled memoiristic things about his interior monologue. And it just sounds so hateable. And yet he's such a wonderful writer and observer of the world. And so this latest one is about essentially his adolescence in, or, you know, someone named Adam's adolescence in Topeka, Kansas, where his parents are shrinks at an institute, a sort of European emigre institute in the middle of Kansas. And so he's sort of a little bit of an other in this town and yet trying to fit in. And he is, Hannah, I actually specially recommended it because he is a competitive high school debater. And that is a huge theme of the book, and the way that he is like working things out about the world is partly through that. And it sort of flashes between his perspective, his parents' perspectives, and the perspective of someone named Darren, who is sort of like sort of a Faulknerian character, but he's also like a everyday Topekan. Anyway, they're pitching it as sort of masculinity in the Trump era and the sort of seeds of what we're living in now. And it kind of is that. So if you're interested in gender from a male perspective, I would read The Topeka School when it comes out this fall. And then I'm only halfway through this one, but I'm so into it that I'm just going to recommend it because, last one. I finally opened The Milkman by Anna Burns. Have either of you read that?
No, I want to. But
I read it. I did read it. It is actually cool. It's amazing. But for my new book club, Noreen Malone, inspired by you, by jealousy of your book club, one of the people chose The Milk. It's very hard to read, but I think just like brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, brilliant. There are people in the group who didn't like it, but it is, I think it's like a real genius kind of voice, like really unusual and weird.
Had been putting it off. So it's a novel that doesn't explicitly say it's about Belfast during the Troubles, but it is about Belfast during the Troubles. It's about a girl who is sort of targeted as a love object by a member of the IRA who is referred to as the milkman, although he's not really a milkman. But yeah, the voice is really arresting because she doesn't use proper nouns at all. She'll say middle sister or younger sister or, you know, like revolutionary. She never says IRA. She never says loyal. She never says any of those words. And instead, it makes you think about what you're actually describing. Mm-hmm. And I had put it off because I was sort of like, it's like an artsy book about an embattled trauma, and there's like a harassment. I was just sort of like, I know I should read this. And I think it's incredible. I think it's really vivid and smart and funny even.
Do you find it hard reading? Because that's the thing that has put me off, that it's like, it's a hard book to read, which Anna, you just said, but...
It's a hard book to enter. It's like, yeah, it's just hard to enter because it's a little bit distant. And so you have to kind of sink into her voice. It's not mannered. That wouldn't be the right word. It's just
it's a
particular
world. Yeah.
It's deep in a consciousness. Like you're entering into someone's mind. And it's fanciful in a certain way just because of the reasons Noreen described. And, you know, sometimes characters talk in her voice. But it's like you're hearing, you know, it's like an early amazing scene where the guys, who's her boyfriend, she doesn't call her boyfriend. I forgot what the...
Maybe boyfriend or something like that. It's
maybe like... boyfriend, something like that. And he is getting together with the dudes and like building cars. But she's describing it. So it's like her particular voice describing this thing, which has all this violence and subtext in it. So you're just kind of watching things pierce through the surface of how she's describing. It's just like nothing is straightforward. But it's also very much about language, I think, because that's a situation in which everything has so much symbolic meaning, like where you stand, where you shop, how you dress, which school you go to. It's like what street you live on. Every little thing is so loaded with symbolic meaning that she kind of does a trick where she does that about language. It's like a very literary novel.
Yes.
And so she plays a lot with words and puts them in other people's mouths. And I think that that's a kind of corollary to what's happening in that situation. So it's really brilliant. I mean, it's really, really brilliant.
And I think it's engrossing. But so the situation where I was reading it was like poolside and floating around a pool, which is like I was able to just concentrate on that. Like I had no other responsibilities. It wasn't like something I was dipping into for 5 pages before bed. Mm-hmm. And I think if I... Well, and which is now my circumstance, and I've been like not making progress. So I think like it's a weird kind of a beach read or a train ride read. Read it when you can like concentrate for stretches and get immersed.
Yeah, and it is also a Me Too-ish novel in addition to being a Troubles novel. And so it does like speak to what we were just discussing, like how little space you can move or be in a situation. She's constantly hounded. She constantly has to fit into the world where the rules are already laid down about how you are allowed to be a woman and where the violence is. And just like you also get the sense of a woman kind of tiptoeing in an extremely narrow space and being watched and hounded the entire time. So it's much more violent situation than Fleischman is in Trouble, but it is a similar set of themes. Okay, well, that was our fifth topic for the night.
We're going long for the last one.
Exactly. We're going long. We're the last show. We get a little bit of indulgence. So I will say this slowly. That was our show for today. Thank you to our wonderful producer, Danielle Hewitt, our production assistant, Alex Barish. Both of you have been amazing. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and The Waves will be back with you next week. Bye.
Discover a career that matters at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Be part of an innovative team delivering world-class healthcare and benefits to America's veterans. Enjoy robust benefits, work-life balance, and career development opportunities. Join a diverse and inclusive community that values your unique background and skills, a community where nearly 1 in 3 of your colleagues are veterans themselves. Apply now at vacareers.va.gov.